Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning to you. This is What's Next on Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. We welcome back Talia Rodriguez. Talia, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. I'm elated to be here. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And there's a lot going on with you. You're involved in a lot of things. But at the top of it, we want to talk about your candidacy for Buffalo School Board. And as I say that, I also want to just encourage any other candidates for a school board, they're always welcome to reach out to us and be part of this program, What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media. But we're talking with Talia. You're going to be going for the West District, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the basic question, I'm sure you get it a lot and you probably have this one ready, but why do you want to be on the school board?
I aspire to serve as a part of my community and also to represent other neighbors like me and people from all over the world. I actually grew up just a couple blocks away watching PBS Kids. I was a PBS kid and my son is a PBS kid. And it's so important to me that education be part of the culture of our city. So I'm really excited at the opportunity to serve. If I am elected, I will be the first Latina in history to ever serve on the school board. And Jay, my grandmother marched with Martin Luther King. She was at the I Have a Dream speech, as was my father. And I'm just really motivated by our diverse communities in the West Side to step forward like my grandmother did into leadership.
I like what you said about trying to make education part of the culture here in the city of Buffalo. So obviously, you have your thoughts, your concerns about what's going on in the Buffalo Public Schools. Maybe outline those for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I usually talk about my candidacy, the first thing I talk about is celebrating what's going well in the schools. You know, I had the privilege, Jay, to help establish a program called Community Schools, which is really keynoted by a Saturday Academy. So for me, part of service would look like understanding what are the things that are going well and celebrating those things and lifting them up and strengthening them. I am a person that comes from a bilingual household. So multilingual learners, people who have learning differences, neurological differences, and learning are people who I would love to advocate for. Other things that I'm excited to do are to celebrate our unions and those adults who are inside the building. I always say when the adults feel confident and are healthy and are doing well, it reflects on the performance of the children. My approach is really to strengthen, to celebrate. And then what I will say is where I get a little bit more technical is data.
Okay.
I'm a very data-driven person, and not so much as data over people, but data to inform the decisions we make about people. And that always brings me to my final point, which is health. So we have a YRBS study, which is a health study that we conduct, the Buffalo Public Schools and our neighbors across all of the schools, and utilizing studies like the YRBS that tell us about how our children are feeling in terms of their safety, nutrition, and the things that they're comfortable with are really, really important to me. And then I would say lastly, sports, arts, and technology. So I want to do everything, Jay.
It sounds like it. And you have the energy for it.
Yes, absolutely.
But back to that study then. So what are you seeing inside the numbers right now?
And yeah.
let's talk about that, and then we can talk about maybe how that could be better implemented in the school district.
Absolutely. So the YRBS data shows us, you know, things that we want to celebrate, that like our children understand how important health is. There's a lot of questions that they ask. Some of them they ask are about personal safety or about body autonomy, what I would say. So what we're seeing is that people who are in middle school are exposed to adult things a lot earlier than maybe some of us think outside of the school. There's also information there about how often they're drinking water. There is information about their interactions with other peers, their interactions with adults. And one of my policy areas, because I have a law degree, a master's degree in public policy, and a poli-sci degree, one of my policy areas is domestic human trafficking and violence against women and children. So there's some questions in there that give us an indication of our children's vulnerabilities, right? And how we can possibly create environments that make them feel more affirmed and safer. There's also questions about how our students identify.
Okay. Yeah. I know that you have been involved in anti-human trafficking initiatives. We've done a few programs on the issue here. And even though I can recall being stunned by some of the information that was shared during those conversations, it doesn't seem to me like it's highlighted enough. What do you see?
I see that when I say human trafficking, the biggest, burliest, toughest looking guys just get quiet, Jay. Because it's something, the magnitude of the social issue itself, right, is very overwhelming, and then it's very emotional, and that's very understandable, right? Again, my policy area is specific to women and children, right. So I have an understanding that I always say that these aren't the things that my neighbors feel comfortable talking about at dinner. But I think what's really important is that for those that want to listen, like those who listen to your program and the awareness that you raise, that they understand where are the resources and where they can receive further training and how they might be able to impact someone's life if they feel that human trafficking may impact them. I think the other thing too, Jay, is people always hear trafficking and they think that it means that you have to like literally move someone.
Right.
And actually, when people ask me questions about my work in that area, they would be like, well, you know, who are the people who you see trafficked the most? And it was American children. And often, I wouldn't say often, but sometimes, Jay, it was by their own parents or caretakers. So there's this feeling about human trafficking that it's perpetrated on others by strangers.
Right.
But that's actually the opposite of what the statistics tell us and what my lived experience has been.
So parents or guardians?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. I'll allow you to be as general as you want, but can you kind of frame a story for me to really, you know, bring that home of a situation where it was just that, a parent or, like you said, a guardian?
Yeah, there was one person who I had met in my time whose the strength of her spirit was just so bright. And her commitment to healing was so bright. And I remember her becoming a mother. And her passion in motherhood. And I remember a conversation I was having with this individual, and I had asked them, like, you know, the first time that you had experienced this, like, what was your experience like? And she just looked at me flatly because she had recognized it and said, my mother was struggling with a substances, and she traded me for the substance. And I believe she was less than 13 years old at the time. And it was to an adult. So for me, you know, you just give a second to pause. But I think one of the things that you'll hear me say in this interview and others is that one of the reasons I aspire to serve is because I've been motivated by the strength of my neighbors, by their work ethic, and by the wherewithal they have to face the challenges every single day of caretaking, of parenthood, of pursuing their own education. So, yeah, and that's a true story. And that's a local Western New York story. But that
surprisingly prevalent in Western New York, would you say most people would be stunned by it?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. But it's one of the reasons I bring it up is because when I talk about my service or how I aspire to serve, it's because I would like to bring the people who are on the periphery, maybe the people whose experiences exist, like kind of in the shadows of the public policy conversations we have right front and center. You know, we have parenting children. We have children who are the victims of violence. We have children who are being trafficked, who attend Buffalo Public Schools. And in my opinion, you need someone that's vocal about that, that has the expert area to tell you how the policies that we hope to implement, that we hope to impact everyone, might impact some of the most vulnerable and most resilient students that we have in our district, Jay.
We ask a lot of the Buffalo Public School District on a lot of different levels, from, you know, obviously educating kids, trying to keep them safe, feeding kids. Are there enough resources inside the school district to do all the things that you want to do?
As a good American, I always say everything can be improved.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You will never hear me say that something
you
can't be improved.
You are on the vast majority.
I think that we always need more resources, and the resources that we need are people resources. I constantly say that the highest resource that we have in Western New York is our social capital. So I think that always more can be done. And what I've seen is when volunteers come in, when 501c3s come in, when grandmas come in, when uncles come in, you know, for bagels with Caretakers Day, those moments make the schools brighter places.
Sure.
So we definitely need more resources. We need more data. We need more volunteers. We need stronger relationships with our corporate neighbors. But I think one of the things that I've seen and I feel confident about is that many people within the schools, as well as many of the people in leadership, have that drive to improve, have that understanding that we are the second largest district in New York State and that other districts look to us for leadership.
We're with Italia Rodriguez today on What's Next. Italia, a mediator, columnist, has a law degree from the University of Buffalo, and also running for Buffalo School Board. Let's get into those priorities, because I know you've talked about this in the past, and we can get into some of these things. So, educational equity.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to us.
Educational equity is the idea that everyone has a equal, I want to say right to mm-hmm. be educated, right? But that right is expressed differently in different places based on people's experiences and their identities. So it's this idea that like equal is wonderful, right? But some people may need two books to reach
right.
the top of the chalkboard
right.
and others might be able to just extend their hand.
Sure.
So for me, as someone that's like really a photo-driven learner, it's kind of the most concise way for me to explain it. But I do feel strongly that American education is something unique and special, and that citizens have this real strong efficacy. Like, we have shaped our schools. American citizens have shaped our schools. And I just want people to feel that sense of efficacy when they walk in their school, that it's their domain and they can influence it and change it and lead it.
You mentioned how you are, I think you said, photo-driven
yeah.
a learner. And I appreciate that, because, and this is something I've been thinking about, is that different people learn different ways,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And I like to think that as much of a struggle as was during the pandemic for remote learning for some, I would like to think that for some kids, not most, but some kids probably did okay with that, maybe even flourished with that type of environment. And I'm wondering, from your viewpoint of the educational system, is that brought into play enough, that idea that, you know, everybody learns at a different level. Everybody learns in a different way. And what are your thoughts on that? I'm kind of curious. I mean, obviously, you're going to learn a lot about the school district here in the coming months, and perhaps maybe beyond that as a member, perhaps, of the school board. But what are your thoughts?
So I think that's a wonderful question. So I am the mother of a child in Generation Alpha who did experience, you know, a different pathway to education because COVID impacted his experience. Like, for example, on the first day, I couldn't walk my son to his classroom. He had a mask on, etc. I think that for Generation Alpha, looking at the generation, I believe that was born after 2000, or after 2017, he loves that term. It's really understanding that everything impacts what school means to them. School's digital to them. Research shows you that they have different levels of attention span. They have different expectations of their learning materials because things are gamified outside of school. So, you know, I do believe that there are some really passionate experts who have dedicated their life to bringing that idea forward. But I think for me, part of it is just my own lived experience of having a really hard time learning how to read. I mean, I had a teacher that sat with me every day in first grade, every morning in her planning session to get me caught up. But Jay, I spoke and read Spanish at that time.
Right.
So I try to use my lived experience to say, as someone that's a bilingual person, someone that comes from a when I was young, a Spanish dominant household, and, you know, being an auditory sensitive person and knowing that photos help tell the story for me completely, it's really important that I center what you're saying in terms of how I approach policy and then also how I approach people's experience in school. School isn't always a safe and affirming place for people.
Right.
And some of it has nothing to do with their learning ability, but more about their identity. And I am a huge, very vocal, unabashed advocate for the LGBTQIA2-spirit community. It's really important to me that students have their identities affirmed inside school and that they feel safe to be themselves. So to answer the question concisely, I do think there's experts that are bringing that idea into implementation, but we really need to look at each group generationally and see what are the national trends and what does learning mean to a kid that knows how to work an iPad before they get to pre-K.
Right.
So the digital literacy part, and then I always answer questions in three parts.
That's fine. We've got lots of time.
Is affirming people's identities and making sure that, you know, the classrooms are as sensorily affirming as possible.
Sensorily affirming as possible. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, I think I know what you mean generally, but I mean, can you maybe describe that classroom for us? I mean, it might be a complicated pathway for any
teacher.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will answer that question through the drive of the teachers. Mm-hmm. So I'm very passionate about teachers, and I have seen teachers and professional staff create environments and hold energy in their room because they purposely work to do so. So I'll just use my lived experience. Sometimes the ability to give a child the opportunity to get out of the seat and sit on a rug.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's the lighting and maybe lowering the lighting, at least during the beginning part of the day, if that's what feels affirming for the group. Sometimes it's, you know, classical music. Sometimes it's just a timeout corner. Sometimes it's a reflection room. But it's just the idea that the environment is responsive to human behavior, and that human behavior drives the environment. So, you know, for our bigger kids, like myself and my son, sometimes that means just like a 5-minute break. But teachers and the school administrators who are really passionate about those school environments kind of set the tone in those spaces. And, you know, I've seen some classrooms that are just filled with art and just you can just walk in and feel the energy.
Sure. Hey, you know, it's interesting as you talk here, you're kind of prompting some really interesting concepts and subject matter. And I do appreciate that because New York State is going to have a cell phone ban now in classrooms. And, you know, from my perspective, as a guy who was in school almost 50 years ago, you know, I can most certainly appreciate that I didn't need any more distractions. But I look at it a little differently also in the sense that, you know, like you just said, some kids are walking into class, they already know how to use an iPad. And I'm wondering if maybe something's being missed with, you know, if every kid's got a cell phone in their hand, maybe there's an educational opportunity there that's, maybe this is, could Do you see this policy as maybe just being a little too narrow?
I think that that's a really poignant question. I tend to favor policy that's hybrid policy, that provides workarounds for people who maybe the absolutism of the policy don't directly serve. But my feeling succinctly is I am pro-technology. Technology is what will drive our children forward. When I talk about relationships with our corporate neighbors, one of the things that myself and Alex and others on my campaign have brought up is that when our children are working inside Buffalo Public Schools, at this time, we do not collect data about where they work. So, you know, if I am preparing if I'm preparing a student and we're thinking about how can they be most successful in the workplace, you know, we want to leverage innovation. We want to implement educational activities, educational opportunities where they feel prepared for the workplace.
Right.
And the workplace increasingly is going to involve more technology. There is a very succinct digital divide between parts of the identities that I represent, specifically the Latino community and other parts of our neighbors. In the West Side, there are people coming from all over the world, and their relationship with technology is different. Their mastery over technology is different. But one thing that I will say is that we need to invite companies and innovators to open up Buffalo Public Schools and say, we want to try the technology. You know, we want to see what a 3D heart looks like inside. We are STEAM and STEM oriented. And, you know, just making sure those pathways for those innovators, as well as supporting our Buffalo Public School students who are entrepreneurial and making innovations in technology. So for me, technology is opportunity, it's industry, it's local business. And it's important to me that we leverage those opportunities in all areas. So the earlier we can get technology into the hands of students, because as we acknowledge, Jay, there may be some students like my son who, you know, have mastered the iPad, and there are going to be other students who have never touched one. So what does that mean about their ability to learn side by side?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. Talia Rodriguez with us here on What's Next. And of course, you referenced Alex with us, Alex Burgos.
And my son.
Alex has been here with us before, and this is the first time we've had AJ in the studio with us here. Fascinating. I mean, let's give a little plug to AJ. I mean, creating YouTube channels at what age?
He started when he was five, and he is a very proud content creator. Latino-driven content that, you know, is hoping to breathe life into our community. AJ, you want to say hi? Hello.
Very nice. Thanks, AJ.
Yeah, thank you so much for acknowledging him and his efforts.
But also within that, though, just the idea kind of highlights what you were talking about here, that we can't limit the possibilities of kids no matter what age.
Absolutely. And the other thing I try to tell him, Jay, my grandma had a third grade education. So in Puerto Rico, she was born without the right to vote. And she was not afforded an elementary school education. Learning and reading was something that was a challenge for her and for other people in my family because she did not have the literacy foundation. But one of the things that she taught me is that your lived experience makes you an expert. Jay, I have a doctorate, and I think only 1-3% of Latinas have the privilege to earn one. When it was time for us to make content hand in hand, you know, there were some that wondered my credentials in doing so. So I think one of the things that I try to tell other caretakers, other moms, and other children is like, curriculum is for all. Right? You don't need to be a quote, an expert to be part of the curriculum conversation. And that, you know, because I have the credentials of having a doctorate, a master's, and a political science degree, others might feel that I might have the opposite perspective on that. But for me, allowing my son to create his own educational content was an affirming message to him that he is equal in driving curriculum and that he can contribute to the learning of other children.
And just to dig down on that a little bit more, I mean, so AJ's learning how to do this, you're guiding him? You're taking him through at hand. I'm sure there's a lot of ears right now like perked up, like, what, really? I mean, some of us are just figuring out how to get onto YouTube, let alone post our own channels.
So what we do is he actually hand draws and he chooses the words, and then I photograph his drawings and input them into Canva, which is a design software. We then come together at that time and figure out what are the elements from Canva that we're going to use. So whether it's a dinosaur, which ones he's going to hand draw. We then go from Canva, we make a video, Jay, and then we upload the video to YouTube. So it's at zero cost to us. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm the type of person, from everything to law school, to motherhood, to the campaign, that my message to my neighbors is, if I can do it, you can do it. So I've talked to caretakers, groups, and everyone about this process that we've implemented that's free to us, you know, excluding the Wi-Fi in my computer,
right,
and our time. But it's just been a really humbling experience to see the way people in the neighborhood are so excited to see Latino-driven content, or content that reflects our Christian core as a family. They've just been really supportive. So he's on Amazon Kindle. We have printed books, but we found that YouTube is oftentimes the great educator. So we upload there for free, and we assess our success in views, as does the rest of the YouTube universe. But even YouTube has been super supportive of him. And, you know, there's ways where they can share your video. So we did a video for National Latino Physicians Day, which I was talking to you about, is October 1st. Shout out to the team in the West Coast and countrywide that are looking to raise awareness about the need for Latinos in the physician and medical space. So it was founded by a doctor out in Stanford who is at this point a friend of mine. So AJ did a book for it. And that was like our first major project where, you know, med students, so many people were just reaching out, and we're like, we're really excited. Thank you for doing this.
And speaking of shout out, can we give AJ's where we can find his
work? Absolutely. AJ, do you want to come to the microphone and say the name of your YouTube channel, and then go back and sit down?
There you go. Your YouTube channel, AJ, is? Yeah.
My channel is called AJ's Hybrid Dinosaur 716. If you don't know how to spell it, it's AJSHYBRIDDINO.
S716, sorry, on YouTube.
Oh, yeah. Very good. All right. Excellent. We're going to take a time out. We're going to come back with more with Natalia Rodriguez here on What's Next. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media and PR.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places, it can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
In a world full of noise, you need a station that cuts through the chaos. That's us. WBFO is now Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR, a new name, but the same trusted news, NPR programming, community connections, and in-depth reporting you count on every day. We know change takes a little getting used to, but you can rest easy knowing that everything you love about this station is right where you left it. BTPM NPR. Listen anytime on BTPM Listen or btpm.org.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next. I'm Jay Moran. Our guest this morning on What's Next, Talia Rodriguez, local mediator, columnist, a lot of other elements to her career, and also trying to put all that energy and run for Buffalo School Board. Well, so we kind of talked about educational equity, and you took us through quite a bit there, and I do appreciate the tangents that you allow me to take with this conversation. Food justice.
Yes.
Food justice in
yes.
the school district. I guess right off the bat, back to data and things along those lines, that's an issue right now in the school district?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's an issue all across the United mm-hmm. States and globally. You know, food security is super important to me. I'm a very food-centered person.
Okay.
In my personal life, Jay, anyone that knows me knows that all I do is eat or talk about food. For me, in the West Side, food is a way where people introduce themselves and their cultures and their experiences. My son eats Egyptian food from the West Side Bazaar. He eats Thai food. He eats Burmese. I think that's just an expression of how much he loves his neighborhood mm-hmm. and the culture of his neighbors. For me as a professional, part of my work has been understanding food security, understanding how we can strengthen the food security system and what roles our schools and higher eds play. So I always start with saying that Buffalo Public Schools is the largest driver of nutrition for children in the city of Buffalo.
No doubt.
And once we...
How well do they do at it?
I think that people do a great job.
Okay.
But that it can be improved.
Okay.
Always.
Fair enough. Sure.
Always improved.
You're back to that Americanism.
Right.
Always can improve. Okay. Gotcha.
I'm never going to say things are good enough, which I think is a reflection of my mother. No, I'm just teasing Jay. But very seriously, food and food culture and food policy is part of my expert area. So just a couple things, you know, when people look at feeding people, the adults, the young people in the building in Buffalo Public Schools, they don't always understand that schools weren't always driven by a universal lunch.
Right.
Right. Or that in many places across the nation, you had to bring your own meal. And if you didn't have one, you didn't have one. Right. So there's been an approach that's changed, like mostly post-World War II, about a school's responsibility to feed. Right. And looking at what are the ways that food insecurity impact our students' experiences. So, you know, I think of some of the expert advocates that I worked alongside in New York City who talked about kids being suspended for stealing food from a cafeteria. Who talked about and implemented, as did someone here, school-based food pantries, right? So there's different ways that food insecurity, kind of the story is told in the story of the schools. Essentially, I think it's our responsibility to understand that no matter who you are, what school you go to, or how much you make, everyone could use a little help. And helping people mitigate what they feel a lot, which is shame, right? So part of my policies were implementing spaces with food dignity, right? Which involves food choice, which involves being considerate to the cultures that people are hailing from, right? And creating opportunities where people can accept food with pride as opposed to with shame. So I helped plan and implement some food pantries in my neighborhood.
Oh, okay.
Some of which are coming up on their 5th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Jay, I have done a lot of stuff in my life through the power of God. There is nothing more humbling second to motherhood than building a food pantry and seeing the look in the face of the children and of the seniors and of my neighbors where they know something good is on the other end of that ramp or at the other end of the line. And I facilitated a hyperlocal consortium as a part of my professional work. In the middle of COVID, we gave out thousands of pounds of food, but also surveyed people while we were doing it and did needs assessments and said, okay, if you're standing on the corner of Tonawanda and Ontario, if you're standing on the corner of Hudson, if you're standing on the corner of Greenwood of anywhere in our district, how do you know where to find food? and what days is it available to you and what kind of food. So spending a lot of time looking at pantry food versus what we call congregate dining. Shout out to one of my mentors in this work, Joe Heary, who runs Friends of Night People and Feed 716. And Joe's perspective is congregate dining. So food that's pre-made, where you give people the opportunity, it's hot, Jay, where you give people the opportunity to sit down. That on top of food pantries, on top of my personal work of building, establishing, and helping my neighbors apply for summer lunch sites, which I was a summer lunch kid. So I just want to remind everybody who's listening, I was a PBS kid, okay? And I was a summer lunch kid, and I went to Head Start. So all of these policies that are up for conversation, I benefited from. And I just want to make sure that they're strengthened and that there's information for caretakers about where they can find food that's nutritional and affirming to their culture.
When you talk about the food pantry, and so you know personally, you see it, the need. At the same time, do you have a sense that that need is truly being put out there where everybody can understand it? It's because, I mean, every time I, you know, it doesn't seem like it ever stops, and it only seems like the need is growing more and more.
It does. And that's when I think of the farmers. I know I talked to you about my mom's dad being from North Collins and being from a family that relied on local homegrown food that they grew themselves. I think the need is being elevated. I know Congressman Kennedy and others work to have a lot of press conferences along with Tara from Western New York Feed More. You know, we have so many food oriented coalitions that I admire, some driven by UB and others, some, you know, directly from our neighbors who have, you know, food cupboards or food refrigerators, or everyone on their block just knows that that's the lady to go to to ask for snacks. But I, one of the things that I think is a message that we can work better on, Jay, is what are the ways that we can include the voices of people who grow the food?
Okay.
And then what are the ways that we can include people from all communities in the conversation about how to strengthen the distribution and feedback cycle? So that's where like my policy language comes out a little bit. But one thing that
What's blocking it? What do you, I mean, if you're talking about policy?
I think just time.
Time?
I think just time. There's so much that we want to do, right? But it's like, how do I pull, again, my family came from North Collins, right? They were dairy farmers. My mom's dad's family. You know, how would I ask someone in those spaces to contribute to the conversations we're having here about food or food justice? So that's when I go back to my reliance on technology. But I think also sometimes it's a change of perspective, and that policy conversations don't have to be a triangle. They should really be a circle.
Fair enough.
With the three sisters in the middle, Jay. I'm just joking. but very seriously, food justice and food insecurity drives my life. And part of my privilege has been strengthening the systems within Buffalo Public Schools and strengthening the communication, and then also advocating for halal food, which is something as a Christian I feel very honored to do.
We were talking with Talia Rodriguez here on What's Next. Talia, running for the school board this coming fall for the West District of the Buffalo School Board. And we mentioned it at the top. We'll mention it as well. We're always welcoming anybody who's a school board candidate. They can come on this program. We'd love to talk to them as well, for sure, here on What's Next. You also, in our conversation here, and again, I keep on picking up these tidbits, but we mentioned an anecdote about, you know, children being suspended for stealing food, which brings us to another issue that has made this program more than once: student suspensions in the Buffalo School District.
Right.
Some alarming numbers that are attached to that. You're going to be running for you are running from the school board. How do you view the student suspension issue in the city of Buffalo?
I view it very much like many of the other issues that we're working on. I view it as something that we need to continue to improve. You know, my son is 8 years old. I have some very strong feelings about suspension in our early grades. I have some very strong feelings about the word suspension,
mm-hmm.
right? Even the word itself is punitive. So for me, being a trained mediator and having studied basically therapeutic jurisprudence, you know, I want to bring in more mediation, right? I want to bring in, where we're able, advocates to help students understand what does it mean to be suspended. If you're a new American or you're someone that has a different lived experience with school, what does that mean, right? Where are you supposed to go in the meantime? I always look at it as an uninvitation, right? And I always say, if we're not going to invite our students into the classroom, we need to be equally as concerned about what their day looks like. So for me, I understand that at different times, for the leader of the classroom and who's trying to build a classroom community, because every school bus, because kids get suspended off the school bus, right. Every classroom, every school building is, in my view, a family, right? That needs cohesive energy in social building. For the leaders in those spaces, I understand why suspension or a disinvitation from that communal space may be necessary. But what I do think is that we need to spend more time looking at the entire system. How often is that happening? Are we disinviting the same child? If we're disinviting the same child, what is that child's reality? What is our responsibility to send work home? Are we sending work home? Does the child know that they can be asked, or does a child know that they can ask for work? Is a child a person that has different abilities? Do they have an IEP? Do they have a 504? Is that being honored in this suspension process? But I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is punitive suspension the easiest methodology to achieve what we want, which is student behavior correction, right? And in many cases, the students are coming back and they're not as resourced because they've been outside of the classroom. If a student is only eating at school, Jay, and they're suspended, what's their food plan? Those are the questions I'd like to ask. And then the last thing I'd like to say, especially for my older students who are experiencing body changes that maybe they don't understand. And again, I'm a boy mom. If a child or a student is not in their best, is not living out their best ability, or isn't in their best spirit that day, and we're working toward a path of disinvitation or suspension, are we asking that child, when is the last time you've had a hot meal? Did you sleep last night? Are you homed? Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So like, we can disinvite a child from a school environment. We can disinvite a child from a classroom community. But what are their social realities when they're disinvited? And is that disinvitation the most effective means to achieve what we're hoping to achieve, both as a community and as a district?
Of course, you're not on the school board yet. So
no, I'm not. I just want to make that clear. I am not.
You're not on the school board.
At this time, no.
So you may not have total access to some of the numbers related to school suspension.
Yeah.
The numbers that have been brought to me, to my attention, are, I won't bias the question by giving any kind of reaction to it. But at the same time, I mean, from what you understand of it, simply put, are there too many going on in the school district?
I think that it is easy to feel as if the correct answer is to disinvite a child. But I think that if we had other options, Jay, our school leaders and our teaching professionals would at times choose those options.
Talia Rodriguez with us on What's Next. We're going to take one more time out. We'll come back with our final minutes with Talia Rodriguez, candidate for the Buffalo School Board for the West District. I'm Jay Moran. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Facts, context, conversation. Your trusted local news source has a new name, but our mission remains the same. BTPM NPR. Explore more at btpm.org or download the BTPM Listen app.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I'm Jay Moran. With us for our final 10 minutes or so here, we have Talia Rodriguez running for this school board here in the city of Buffalo. Talia, you know, you're a proud West Sider.
I am.
Tell me about the West Side.
Ooh, good food, Jay.
Yeah?
Good food, lots of spice, lots of attitude, lots of cultures. I am so proud of my neighborhood. I would say themes in the West Side are service. Neighbors will always help other neighbors. Cultural exchange. I've always lived my life in the West Side knowing that the West Side is an international destination and that people from all over the world were working to get there. And then three, just legacy. So my mom's Sicilian family lived in the West Side from the late 1910s, I think, if not earlier than that. And I always was taught to be proud of being from the West Side. And I've joked when I've said this in other spaces, it's because I didn't really have that much else other than that place-based pride.
Sure, sure.
But that place-based pride has fueled me through law school, through some experiences that were really challenging to me socially. I knew that I was going to come out on the other side because I'm a West Sider.
And I love how you describe it as a world destination neighborhood,
Oh, yes.
Right? I think I saw some of this in you know, just looking up some of the different media accounts for you. And you made some comments about immigration and also about what you are either seeing or are concerned about seeing on the West Side when it comes to enforcement of immigration policy.
Yeah.
Are you seeing, or are you hearing about, you know, like we have also heard about, a greater presence of ICE officials or ICE personnel in the West Side? What are you, I'm just kind of curious to see what you're seeing on the ground.
So I want to start by saying that I have a very strong respect for law enforcement, as several of my family members chose law enforcement, and a very strong respect for civil justice and the need for police and law enforcement presence. But I want to speak for my neighborhood and say that people are giving birth in basements because they're too scared to go to hospitals, that you will never see some people's parents enter into the school, that there is a feeling right now that is purposely being driven and cultivated in my neighborhood of fear. And I don't believe in it. And I don't believe in the principles that are fueling it.
I think that was well stated. Thank you very much for that response. Getting back to a couple of your priorities back to the school board, I kind of like to help you drift into some national politics here, but I know you
Well, they impact our schools.
There is no doubt about that. And one of your policies or priorities, fighting for teachers. Again, maybe a group of professionals not necessarily getting the love they deserve on the national level right now. What about how it can maybe be changed in the Buffalo School District?
I think the first thing is data, right? So our teachers come out of their pocket every single year. There's a teacher shopping right now listening to me for her classroom, Jay.
If I know teachers, they got it done in July when it was cheaper.
fair. But very seriously, I want to understand how much do my teachers spend out of their own pocket to teach? You know, I want to understand how can we better support their mental health experiences? How can we better help them understand their neighborhoods and the places in which they serve if they're not from those places? You know, teachers are people who impact us. I remember telling you a story of a teacher that impacted us. They're the people that allow us to believe in ourselves. And for some people, they don't get that message at home. So a teacher or a teacher's aide, I'm very big about supporting the entire educational professional staff because I have family members. Shout out to Titi, who's a teacher's aide. My sister was a teacher's aide at one point. Teachers and our teaching professionals need more empathy. They need more help. They need more supplies. They need more love. They need more coffee days. I think it's easy to overgeneralize and say, oh, you know, well, you know, it's so easy for them because they work as a Black, and every teacher is bringing their entire emotional spirit to school at whatever capacity they can. And celebrating them and creating literal physical spaces that are teacher spaces where they might be able to have a 5-minute reflection, or being able to get a call from a senior teacher if I'm a new teacher. Hey, how was your day today? You know, I know it's only fourth period, but how are you feeling about your teaching practice? I think is important. I'm passionate about the people that drive the schools, include everyone up from the engineers who literally held my hand at 8 months pregnant with this guy as I walked down the stairs or up the stairs, the 3 flights at Lafayette as our elevator was being constructed.
Oh, no.
But like, there's so much love in the people that drive every day to our schools. And I think one of my privileges and one of the things I've tried to do is to lift up their energy and say to them as a community, I see you, whether you're an engineer or a teacher or an administrator, you're to be valued. And that's part of the energy that I want to bring in my service.
You, I think, announced your candidacy for the school board maybe as far back as January, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Who are you finding support from? How are you going about getting support?
So I'm laughing because I just think my creator is so good. I have found support in so many people.
Okay.
People hugging me, Jay, saying what your principles are reflect everything I believe in. People ask me tough questions. I mean, this is West Side on 10th Street. They want to know these things, okay? And answering them. And
give me a tough question that you heard. I'd like to, I mean, you know.
Oh, a good...
Because I'm going to write it down and use it for the next guest, but anyway.
All those tough questions start with, what are you going to do about?
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
And then
fair
it's
enough.
Fill in the blank. Well, but for me, women who are in their 80s, specifically women who are in their 80s.
Yeah.
I have knocked on doors of women who have lived and loved and fed and raised the West Side, who have embraced me, who have invited us into their kitchen. Okay. And you know, in the West Side, that's a big deal.
Right.
Right. Sit at my kitchen table, who are saying they're going to pray for me. I have met people who are new to Buffalo, you know, within weeks, who, when I talk about my candidacy or how I want to include them, are so excited. I've had people thank me for running almost every single day. Like, I've had men, people of all genders, people of all backgrounds, people of all languages, literally embrace me, like hug me and be like, I'm rooting for you. You're going to make it. I've sat on my neighbor's porch where they've been like, you know what? I'm going to see you there, speaking life into me. But conversely, there's been some days where it's rained on us, where those doors weren't open, where maybe I didn't feel as capable as I left the door. And on those days, I thought about my grandma marching with Martin Luther King with one dress, you know, not knowing what the future was going to hold for her and her 7 children, a resident of public housing, someone that had been impacted so much by policy that she really couldn't control. And, you know, I've walked right back into the car and had conversations with Alex or AJ or called my ma. Been like, Ma, I don't know about today. I don't know about today. But in the sense of the West Side and in just America in general, I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to go away. And my perspective and the people who I'm fighting for, they're ready for a change, Jay. They're ready for new energy, and they're ready to empower me with service. And that's something that is a very humbling feeling. I know I keep using that word,
sure.
But for a little girl that sat on the porch, it's a big deal.
And what also can be humbling in elections, and unfortunately with school board elections, so sometimes it's just getting the vote out can be very difficult. What about that? I mean, you got a strategy for encouraging people to, I mean, other than, you know, I mean, it's great that you walk up to somebody's front door and you knock on it, but if they don't come out for election day?
I would say un fiesta, right?
Wow.
GOTV.
Okay.
GOTV is going to be a party. I was able to witness political campaigns in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
I was here in the early 90s when there were some of the first people running, like Quintana and others, who just brought so much energy to my neighborhood. And in Puerto Rico, the election day, como un fiesta, hay parada, there's just this energy in politics in Latin, in South America, specifically Latin America, Puerto Rico, that I was able to witness. So, you know, I hope to bring myself in that process and bring in that energy. And then also an affirmation to my neighbors, like, this is your $1.8 billion. This is your school board seat. This is your neighborhood. This is your city. This is your future to forge. And today is the day we set that tone. So for me, it's so much about breathing life into people and about poising myself to receive their direction.
Talia Rodriguez, the hour flew by.
I know, Jay. I like you. I'm like, we could talk forever.
Absolutely. Well, you've been well-versed on a lot of things, and I appreciate you diving into a lot of these different issues throughout this hour. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for being here, Jay.
Talia Rodriguez, mediator, columnist, so much more, and also a candidate for the school board of Buffalo from the West District. And again, just a reminder that anybody who is running for the school board would love to hear from you. If you want to come on this program, come on in. It's an open invitation here on What's Next. My name's Jay Moran. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.